Hello, my pod. I'm Cree Hugh, son of Tom Hugh, and welcome to this very special Man of Steel spoilers special Empire podcast. Special. Over the next hour or so, we'll be discussing the ins, outs, whys, and wherefores of Zack Snyder's Superman reboot with Snyder himself and writer David S. Goyer, and we'll also be chewing the fat over the whole damn thing ourselves. For that, I'm joined by Dan Jolin, Kryptonian name, Dojo, the man who wrote Empire's 4-star review of Man of Steel, Ali Plum, Kryptonian name, A. Plums, who interviewed Zack Snyder for the podcast, and Helen O'Hara, Kryptonian name, Helen O'Hara, who jumped in for the interview with David S. Goyer. How are you all? You all good?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. We're going to be nattering for about 30 to 40 minutes, then the Snyder-Goyer interviews will be placed at the end if you want to skip on past our ramblings. So, shall we begin? I'm going to point out, this, first of all, before we start, this is an interesting mix of people, because you three guys all loved or really liked Man of Steel, and I'm in the opposite camp, so please don't gang up on me too much. But hey ho. So Dan, let's start off with you. Your general thoughts on general thoughts on the film. You're very much.
Yeah, I was largely positive. I really enjoyed it as an absolutely huge, intricate sci-fi spectacular.
Yeah.
Which I really don't feel I've seen from this character. This franchise in its various incarnations before. So, I've got to confess, my favourite stuff was the opening stuff on Krypton. You know, I kind of felt, I think I said something along these lines in my review, I kind of felt that, you know, you've got a film that starts with Russell Crowe flying a four-winged dragon across blasted skies with a shattered moon in the background. You kind of, you know where you're going.
Shattered moon, first of all, is the theme of the year. This is now the third film this year where we've seen a shattered moon in the sky.
Wow.
I completely missed
Do you know the name? Do you know the name of the shattered moon?
Not the one of Krypton.
No. Wegthor.
Yeah, I agree. Any planet that has four-winged dragons should surely be placed on some kind of planet preservation list, which means that it wouldn't explode.
Yeah, you know.
Where were the Green Lantern Corps when Krypton exploded? That's what I want to know.
That's a genuinely good question.
Still apologising.
That's a relevant question. But going back to what I thought of the film, I did like the fact that, you know, it wasn't. There were a few Easter eggs which we'll come on to, but it wasn't trying to do the kind of, oh, JLA, we're going to do JLA, sorry, Justice League America, or anything like that. It was self-contained. It treated Superman as for a while, the only Kryptonian on the planet, and then one of just a few, and, well, I don't want to spoil the end. It's a spoiler podcast.
It's a spoiler podcast.
I'm so used to not spoiling things.
So, yes, you should spoil the end.
And, yes, and then he was the only Kryptonian again. Oh, I could say it. Oh, that feels good.
Or is he?
And I kind of thought it was interesting that wasn't about Clark Kent, really. Or rather, I kind of guess that started before. I like the way it started before he's at the Daily Planet.
Yeah.
So you have a different structure to it.
Basically,
all took place before
he's at the Daily Planet. This was kind of Smallville writ large.
I guess. I never watched Smallville.
Yeah.
So I couldn't really compare it.
I mean, I enjoyed Smallville.
It had its moments.
But exactly. It's a bit of a, okay.
Okay, I'm more of a Lois and Clark generation.
Me too.
Yeah, I also watched that.
I was really proud of myself. Can I be boastful?
Mm-hmm.
I was really proud of myself because months and months and months ago, I predicted the end of the film. I was really happy. In other words, I said, we're not going to see Clark Kent. This film is going to be the origin of Clark Kent. At the Daily Planet, in his glasses, being, you know, possibly bumbling, but anyway, being a different persona to Superman. We don't see that. And that was going to be the equivalent of the Joker card at the end of Batman Begins, him turning up in the glasses. And I said this months ago, and that's exactly how it ended.
So, yeah, I agree that Krypton was a bit of a treat. Like, I said as much in the interviews that really gave me confidence seeing it. Like, and I wanted to be more in that world and spend more time there. And I think it's telling that was originally going to be about 45 minutes long and had to be really cut down.
I think the Kryptonians probably wanted to spend a bit more time there as well.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I love that. It had a lovely pulp 60s feel. I mean, that looks like that's the book covers on my dad's bookshelf right there. You know, that's proper old school sci-fi. And I love that. I mean, even apart from this film, I think we're seeing that more and more in cinema. That's part of the reason I loved Thor. It's part of the reason I loved Avatar. It's like that big, crazy, mad sci-fi that we're finally seeing on the big screen. Because, you know, our abilities.
Maybe it means we'll finally get an Ian M. Banks adaptation one day.
Huh. Well,
what do you think?
I think that we might be dreaming the dream there a little bit. But fingers crossed.
Or Dan Simmons, Ilium.
Oh, yes.
Or Olympos.
Yes.
That'd be amazing.
I loved Krypton. I love the Krypton sections. I love Richard Donner's Superman the movie and Richard Donner / Richard Lester's Superman 2, which is a huge basis for this movie. I think this movie is effectively accordions both those movies into one. But Krypton they never quite got right. It has that amazing John Williams theme as that great shot panning past the red sun to Krypton, and then it just becomes a series of smaller models with people walking around with tinfoil on them.
And some black lights, some good,
and some nice back projection. Guilty. Obviously they didn't have the budget to realize Krypton in the way that they do in this movie, and it is immense. I love that stuff. I really did. And I thought, personally for me, I think Russell Crowe is the best thing about this movie. I thought
he was
fantastic.
Great in it, yeah,
this was a different Jor-El than we've seen before on the big screen,
and a more kind of coherent one, and a very sort of. You know, in the sense that, you know, the for this example, the Smallville one was quite sinister at times, and that didn't quite feel right. And Marlon Brando was Marlon Brando, really. And this felt like a dad a lot more. And even though he hadn't really had time to be a dad, he felt like he was acting from that place, if you like. Yeah.
But he doesn't. The other thing is, he's a dad who hasn't aged. So he feels closer to Cal as well. So we see him engaging in action. We see him as a man of action. A practical figure rather than just a voice.
But also, I mean, that clearly comes from, you know. So everyone on Krypton, apart from Cal, has been born and bred to a purpose, and he's clearly been born and bred as a scientist. But even aside from his potentially scientific desire to experiment with natural birth and potentially coming from a place of love and romance and la la la, he's clearly also fighting against his own limitations. He's clearly taught himself to be a fighter as well. He's clearly kind of pushing beyond what destiny has kind of made for him, and I think that kind of feeds into his relationship as well, which I really liked.
You can really sense with the Superman the movie that Marlon Brando was kind of slumming it a little bit. You know, he showed obviously a loyalty to Richard Donner by refusing to come back when Donner was fired. So that's why Susanna York is in Superman 2 and not Marlon Brando, at least the Lester cut. But you can see why Russell Crowe signed on to this, because he gets to do some great action. He plays a man who has the most virile sperm on the planet of Krypton, and that would be an appeal for any actor. Yes, I'm the guy who breaks the century cycle. Yeah, I guess I can see that. Yeah, I'll do that. Absolutely. I thought he was really, really good. And I'm glad that they brought him back at the movie in a more active role.
That was surprising how much he's in the film.
I like that.
I really thought he was going to just be there and then go, and then that was that, and maybe, you know, be a floaty hologram for a while. But actually, talking about that, I loved the solid-state technology, the Kryptonian solid-state technology. I thought that was great. That kind of everything's formed from this kind of carbonite almost.
That was proper weird.
I'm doing something with my hands here. Sorry.
It works really well with my hands, but
it really sells it.
Nick DeSimian described it as, he's trying to describe it to some of your Steve Gunn. Yeah, so Jor-El's, he walks around in Krypton and he's accompanied by a talking parking meter. you just see people's faces going, what? A talking parking meter?
And then Cal carries him around on a USB stick. So, you know, it all works out.
I think more like a 3D Etch-A-Sketch. You know what I mean?
I think of them as kind of floating metal baby cots with Promethean snakes at the bottom of them.
You could say that, or you could say a talking parking meter.
Yeah, either or. One thing I will say is I really enjoyed how they incorporated Lois Lane, who is often someone you can't really put into action, and you can't give her action moments. Mm. But that series of beats where it is the hologram or essence of Jor-El walking around, opening doors, shutting doors, shoot left, shoot right, go up, go down, move the face to the right. Yeah. Like, there were comic beats there, and it was good action. I was excited by that. I just thought that was a really clever piece of writing.
I thought generally she was really, really well done. I'd agree with you. I think the limitation on her character was maybe there wasn't enough time with Clark, so that doesn't quite sell the romance because they simply don't have enough scenes together. Their scenes that they do have together are actually quite nicely played, but they're really brief, really, really brief.
There was a sense of a lack of depth. You says as much in the review, where each character, I enjoyed each character for what they were worth. They fulfilled their purpose. I didn't feel like they, you know, were like, hang on, why did they do that? That makes no sense. But I really wanted more time, like you say, with each one to do them justice and really get into their hearts and minds and souls. But we didn't really get that. We just got a lot of CGI. Shazam covered that.
Yeah, I think the kiss at the end took me slightly by surprise. I wasn't sure they'd entirely earned that.
Yeah, which is not a problem as well.
I hate to keep going back to Superman and Superman 2, but that wasn't a problem with that. They spent a lot of time on the Lois Clark / Lois Superman weird love triangle that goes on with those two.
I do like that Lois knows, though, because honestly, girl,
yeah,
come on.
I know, I know, but also you have to ask, doesn't everyone know? I mean,
that's the biggest thing.
We were discussing this in the office, and we were discussing whether Perry knows at the end, and I had the very strong feeling that he was kind of aware. And David S. Goyer, I've got to say, kind of agreed with me on that. He thought Perry was in on
it. He sees them kiss.
Yeah.
That's not just because him hunky man, her like hunky man. There's obviously something else going on.
Oh, yes. And by the way, it takes, what, 143 minutes for someone to point out that he's handsome? Please.
No. Not handsome. Kind of handsome.
Kind of hot.
That whole bit where she, who is a private, next to the general, who's in charge of basically the army. Right, so the satellite crashes down to Earth because Superman has thumped it there. Mm. Superman is there floating, going, you want to find out where I hang my cape? Clang. You can't do that.
Go away.
Leave me alone. He was trying to essentially do an Iron Man thing of, look, I'm really powerful. You have to trust me. I have to trust you, and we will be fine. I've saved the bloody world. Calm down. He goes, no, you can't do that. You broke my satellite. That costs a lot of money. And this private next to the Chief Von General Mega Dude goes, I'm sorry. He's kind of hot. He's the guy who saved the world. And look at him. Look at him. When he first arrived and he walks around behind the building, after he saved people on the rig, he's topless and he's wearing these scrappy shorts.
I wanted
to get up and leave because I was so offended by
I texted my wife and said, honey, it's over. I'm sorry. I'm now batting for the other team. This is...
It didn't turn me. It just made me angry.
It didn't turn me.
Yeah, sure.
He's blushing.
What's wrong with you people?
No, he was just... what I'm saying is, in a backwards way, is that he certainly...
He's a manly hunk, Dan!
Okay. By the way, can I just point out, he did save the world, but also he was the cause of its near destruction.
Well,
just
not
saying.
Necessarily. They might have come anyway to the, you know...
They only got drawn. They only got drawn by him. By him being there.
It did have
That's
a bit
not
of a
his
problem.
Fault. You can't blame him for that.
Well, no, but what I'm... You know, I mean, and also, let's face it.
And
this is something else I pointed out briefly in the review. He's as responsible for as much destruction as anyone else.
Yes.
It's like, take it outside, dude.
No, this was a big problem, I think, for me with the film. It's like every other fight scene we've ever seen Superman do, and this is what sets him apart from many other superheroes. It's not just about fighting. It's also about making sure no one else is hurt while you're fighting. Mm. So, you know, that's something that the Donner and Lester films did, where he would, you know, with one hand he'd be fighting Zod and Ursa and so on, and the other hand he'd be catching buses full of school children and pushing them out of the way and stopping buildings from toppling and so on. And there isn't that in these fight scenes, generally speaking.
Although, is that reflective of modern America?
Oh gosh, enough! Damn.
I wanted more people saving. Generally,
I was with the movie. I really liked the Krypton stuff. I was with the movie for the first hour or so. Then General Zod turns up, and it kind of started losing it for me after that point. And the endless fight scenes in Metropolis, when you compare them, and again I'm doing it, I'm so sorry, but when you compare the fight scene in Metropolis between Zod and Superman to the Superman, Zod, Ursa, and non-fight in Superman 2, there's not an ounce of the wit, imagination, or humanity, more importantly, of those fights. The scene with the bus where Superman literally is yelling, no, the people, and they see that as a weakness in Superman, and they play upon it by trying to hurt as many innocent people as they possibly can. And Superman takes the fight away from Metropolis because he realises that too many people, too much destruction, and too many deaths will be on his head.
To be fair, there are scenes of him intervening to save people in the fight as well.
In this film he is doing both things.
Yes, but generally it's, I mean, the main one I remember is him intervening to save the life of a soldier, which, commendable, don't get me wrong, I don't, you know, I'm not callous about soldiers, but there's none of that sort of intervening for the innocent so much, until that last scene with Zod, which we talked to David Goyer about, and that's that kind of, it feels like that comes out of nowhere rather than flowing from the events of the entire fight.
There were some action beats that could feel a little cribbed, especially within the Battle for Smallville. Generally, I found very enjoyable seeing Zod fly through the petrol station. The petrol station blows up. He has the whole too much sensory overload. I was like, wow, this is really clever. This will be how they make the two of them fight in an interesting way. That kind of fell by the wayside a bit and then came back, and then we'll talk later about how the powers kind of are a bit fudged. How do you get power? Is it the atmosphere? Is it the sun? Anyway, it was interesting to notice in Smallville, that's where we got most of our product placement. Sears, U-Haul, IHOP.
LexCorp.
IHOP are doing very well.
They pay a lot of money.
Nokia, though.
It's funny because you see Mark Kent wearing a Sears like band around her neck and you go, wow, you're really taking this all the way through. Of course, you've got Nokia, all the journalists at the Daily Planet not using Apple products. Come on. I mean, really. I asked Amy Adams whether she, you know, her Lois Lane would be on Twitter. She was like, no way. She's not Twitter. She's not going to do it. And that makes sense, considering one of the comic beats was her unable to use a photocopier. Anyway, Battle of Smallville.
one of the comic beats.
But yes, the action beats within the Battle of Smallville echoed, maybe intentionally, I think they kind of have to be, when the Hulk jumps onto onto the plane, onto the MiG, basically, and then rips off the shield of the cockpit and starts thumping away. Well, that's very Hulky.
That was very similar.
I do wonder how tricky it is.
Picking up Superman and slamming him into the floor like he's, you know, a rag doll.
Yeah, but I've been making this film a long time.
Yeah. I know that.
It's very hard to.
But I'm saying
it is. But at the same time, those are two beats that you could have cut out
or tweaked or something
since last.
I'm not saying it's a copy. I'm not saying that. I'm just feeling like it's not. Entirely original for whatever reason, but for what it's worth, I thought the quick movement of the way Feyora just kind of darted round. She'd kind of zoom 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 zoom, like punching people. It felt a little bit like a beat 'em up computer game, but I was into that.
I thought the effects were great.
I thought it was just a relentless onslaught.
By the way, we saw it in 2D. You saw it in 3D.
Regrettably, yes.
Yeah, I saw it in 3D as well.
It made not an ounce of difference.
Can I just say how weird it was seeing the Syncope logo in 3D? It just felt wrong.
It did feel wrong, didn't it?
Yeah.
The what?
The Syncope logo.
The Nolan company.
Oh! Yeah.
When he first goes not to the Fortress of Solitude, but to the scout ship that's buried under this mega ice plateau.
That is the Fortress of Solitude.
Yes, but it's not like no one calls it that or anything like that. Yeah, it's a little bit of a fudge on that front. It kind of is, it kind of isn't. It's a scout ship that was left there 20,000 years ago.
We asked for some people to send in comments and questions on Twitter last night, and then I realised that people could read spoilers in our timeline, so I took that down very quickly. But one of the questions that came through was someone asked, how did the suit get on the ship?
It's a replicator. I think that's the only thing that makes sense. Basically, I mean, it's just, you know, Jor-El's been uploaded from his USB stick into the scout ship and then has it created.
Read his vital statistics with his brain.
Yeah, because, I mean, he kind of has to, though, because he can't have done it much before that.
Yeah, exactly.
It wouldn't fit.
But why isn't it black like everything else? And why is it thinner and lighter and
why
stuff?
Why is it blue?
Perhaps it's... He also, I mean, listen, this is a giant alien, mega powerful scout ship, okay? So let's assume that he's also able to scan Earth technology and come up with something appropriate.
And also his, you know, Jor-El, which I really enjoyed, wears that cool battle armour. It's kind of almost robotic. I really like that design. Generally, the design, as we all discussed, Krypton is fantastic. Doesn't Supes deserve a little bit of battle armour?
He doesn't need it.
Maybe he doesn't need it because he's on Earth and he's invulnerable
actually,
on Earth.
He doesn't want to block out the sun too much.
But also, I'm thinking maybe the red and blue would actually make sense from Jor-El's point of view because it's red for Krypton and blue for Earth. I'm just making this up, but I like it. Yeah. I'm going to stick with it.
Do you think he'll throw a little Hot Rod Red in there next time? Maybe.
But when he walks out from that and he puts his fist to the ground and the earth shakes and he has a couple of grace notes and slams into the floor. When he flies around the earth, he goes through, I don't know whether you noticed, he goes through the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
He goes
White Cliffs of Dover.
Past the White Cliffs of Dover. And I just had a big smile on my face just going, oh, good for you. You put in Britain for some reason. And then it's through the plains of Africa and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. I wish that lasted longer. That gave me such a thrill.
I wish he'd pushed the Leaning Tower of Pisa over a little bit more. That would have been great.
There's a big grin on Chris's face there. But yeah, for the lack of humour, there are very subtle little touches occasionally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember one of the things I laughed at was somebody just breathing in a funny way. I can't remember what it was. I always laugh at weird stuff in films. I'm always the only one in the cinema sort of going,
I tell you, I laughed when Lois Lane walks in and goes, damn it, I'm a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist.
Yes, I was having flashbacks to the Hudsucker Proxy.
Yes, it was the Hudsucker Proxy. I'm sure that was a Hudsucker Proxy gag.
I'll bet my Pulitzer on it.
Helen, you've got some interesting points. Point at Helen.
Thanks, Chris. Well, I don't know. I was going to bring up a couple of little tiny details. First of all, I thought there were some nods here to Edna Mode. Deborah Snyder yesterday described Krypton as very much a cape society.
Cape culture,
I apologise. And that's true. You can't have Superman, I don't think, without a cape. You can reimagine the costume a bit, but you've got to have a cape. But it did get him into trouble in a couple of moments, which I quite enjoyed in an Edna Mode styley. There's a couple of times where he's caught by his cape and then has to, you know, fight somebody a bit more than he
wanted.
Why
didn't it rip?
Because it's made of super strong material, Dan. Jeez.
Oh, yeah.
There's so much post-op fudging we're doing here. And well, of course, this, that and the other.
The other thing I like is that this is essentially, my alternative title for this movie would be How Toby from the West Wing Saves the World. Because actually, I mean, you know, Jor-El actually says at one point, you know, you're here to inspire people, you're here to lead people. Jonathan Kent, obviously Kevin Costner, says the same thing.
And the other Robin Hood.
The other Robin Hood, yes. And And it actually, you know, it is technically Toby who presses the button at the right time and ensures that the giant gravity machine is exploded and sent to the Phantom Zone.
And he never makes it out.
And he doesn't make it out. He sacrifices himself. He's the real Jesus figure
just
here.
Just like he did in The Lost World. Do we have a moment's silence for Toby?
Toby, we hardly knew you. We should mention it's actually, of course, Richard Schiff, and we love him, and his name is Dr. Emil in this.
Yes.
I was also pleased to see a couple of Battlestar Galactica people in there
Tamo
quite
Peniket,
early on.
And I've forgotten his real name, but Lieutenant Gator.
The guy who plays Gator, yes. Being Gator.
Oh, thanks, Guy. Par Kent, can we talk about how he's an idiot? The work experience person who came in today pointed out quite rightly after he'd seen the
name,
film.
He has a name, Ali.
He's called Charlie.
He has a name.
He walked in and said, you know, can I just point out that Par Kent's an idiot? And I was like, I know! But in his defence, he's a man of honour and also he gets his foot stuck. Look, he loved the bloody dog and he got his foot stuck.
But it's a dog.
I'm not the first person to point this out. Someone else pointed this out on the internet. I was reading a spoiler message board about it last night. Jonathan Kent, when he dies, basically puts his hands up to say, "No, Clark, don't reveal yourself to the world in front of me, in front of everybody, because the world's not ready." Blah, blah, blah. But Superman can move at close to the speed of light, so he could actually have run over there, saved his dad without anyone seeing.
No,
shush, nonsense.
Could have done it.
No,
easily could have done it.
This is before they've established he can actually fly to his full potential, right? Isn't it? He's not yet at the.
He hasn't started developing.
He knows he can do something.
I don't think. I mean, moving at the speed of light.
And he loves his dad.
On.
His dad says no, and he's about to kill himself. You give yourself a couple of seconds to think about it, and then tornado.
I did wonder about Krypton forming Earth. Because, I mean, if Krypton has, like, a completely different gravity and atmosphere, wouldn't it be easier to just do that on another planet?
Also, you get to be Superman if you stay here.
I know.
I did wonder about that, because there's that line from Zod where he says, "We don't want to wait all that time like you did to learn to deal with all this amazing power that would make us superior on this world. We just want to kill everyone and make it like home."
I don't think he's thought it through.
But I don't think he has thought it through, but he is genetically created.
Yes.
To be like that, isn't he? So he is, by his very nature, narrow-minded about the whole thing. So I do kind of get that. And all he ever wanted to do was... I mean, actually, you know, actually, I like this. Him and Jor-El had the same motive.
Mm.
It's just they went about it in different ways
that
were predetermined by their very natures.
And actually, I mean, the Krypton is quite interesting because it has clearly stagnated. And they make that quite clear. You know, if a ship 20,000 years old is still compatible with the same technology, then Krypton clearly hasn't been going the way it should do. So, you know... maybe it deserves to die even with the four winged dragons. I'm sorry.
But I'm double confused because the other planets which they terraformed and were part of their society, it was implied that these other planets
had all failed.
They weren't in connection with the mother.
Well, also, but how decadent is Krypton if like none of its colonies have survived? That seemed
very strange because surely if they do terraform Earth and they do make it like Krypton and everyone there is Kryptonian and they have loads of crypto babies and it's all great, then surely without the mother planet, they'll die as well. I didn't see that. And also, for all this, we don't want to wait to learn all of this. He picks it up pretty quickly when it's the final fight.
I guess that's just, you know, adaptability through necessity or something that comes with him being one of the warrior caste or something.
You've got to love how Kal-El also gives him the key to do that. He says, you just need to focus at one point during one of the fights, and then he does focus in the next fight, and then he's able to deal with it.
But there is that little element of, this really hit home when finally, and I can say this, he kills Zod. That he doesn't want to kill these guys. He is aware that this is his last link to the world he was from. These people are his people. They're his species.
Yeah.
So it's to some degree he's related to them.
Yeah.
And he doesn't... I don't think he really wants to be in a position where he's killing anything. He doesn't want to kill Zod at the end.
He doesn't want to have to choose between two worlds, which is essentially the position that the film puts him in.
I think he makes a very clear choice quite early on.
He makes a choice
to... Team Earth.
Yeah, he is Team Earth, but at the same time, that doesn't mean he wants Krypton to die, but he's put in a position where that's essentially the choice he has to make. He can keep nothing of Krypton if he wants Earth to survive, and that's the position that he's put in. So it's quite... It's one thing to make your choice, and it's another thing to make it as irrevocable as all that, I guess. It's the difference between Toy Story 2 and Toy Story 3, if you will. And this also echoes for me, and this may be the nerdiest thing even I have ever said, but it echoed the Doctor Who and the Master Beats in the...
Master Beats.
The Master... moments, if you will, thank you, in the last David Tennant series of Doctor Who, because I thought he and John Sims had a similar kind of dynamic where he just wanted John Sims to kind of stay around and be his mate, and he couldn't because he was too evil.
Damn it.
Sorry.
Damn it. That's not the dirtiest thing you've ever said.
Oh, thanks.
You said way nerdier than that. No, I thought he made a very clear choice towards the end. The Killing Sword thing. A couple of things I want to talk about.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the Jonathan Kent thing. We didn't talk about that in full detail. Because they're two very, very different fathers. But let's get on to that in a second. But Killing Sword. Where do we stand on that? I'm very much against it.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing. I mean, you're going to hear David Goyer talking about this in a little bit. And they thought about it quite a lot. It's interesting that this makes Superman actually break Batman's one rule, which I think is quite unusual.
Which Batman kind of breaks.
Oh, I'm sorry, Batman's one rule, the sidebar, is ridiculous. There is no way he can control the amount of violence that he levels out, not ever killing anyone. It's crazy. Anyway.
Well, actually, no, he doesn't kill Ra's al Ghul in Batman Begins. He technically doesn't kill him. No court in the land.
All the time. Like, he drops a guy from the second floor. He doesn't know that that guy definitely will only break a leg. It's crazy.
He's a genius.
Shut up.
He's a genius.
He could have a predetermined weakness somewhere that just causes complications.
That's not Bruce Wayne's fault.
Yes, it is.
It's not his fault.
Legally speaking, he would be liable.
Well, what are you, like a trained barrister or something?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Anyway, my point
is, I think Superman probably killed more people during this film than Batman did during any of the Dark Knight trilogy.
This is also true. But yeah, that's a really interesting thing. And I mean, yeah, so you're going to hear David Goyer talk about this. I don't want to preempt him too much, but they put a lot of thought into this and they kind of went back and forth on it quite a bit. And I think it comes down again to that choice between Earth and Krypton. Yeah. Like they can't leave
them anything.
It makes
sense for the themes of the film. It makes perfect sense. He needs to end up being the last Kryptonian there is.
Last son of Krypton, if you will.
Indeed.
Or is he? When he's in the scout ship, there's lots of pods in there with dead people inside, dead Kryptonians inside them, but one pod is empty. And I think someone has said in an interview, maybe Goyer, that could be Supergirl.
Huh.
So she might already be on Earth. In which case, where is she? Why doesn't she reveal herself? And why don't they pick her up, her Kryptonian energy signal as well?
Does that mean she's 20,000 years old?
Yes. Or is he immortal? Can he, he ages at the same rate as humans, but does he stop aging? I've always wondered this about Superman. For example, in Mark Millar's Red Sun, which goes really, really, really far into the future, he kind of stays the same age, doesn't he, for a long, 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 long time. So does Superman get to 33 and then just stop?
It's funny, or same thing with Wolverine. He kind of grows but kind of doesn't. Like, there's a good comic book where he confronts Sabretooth for the final time and they're both basically old dudes with long grey hair. It's a real curiosity question. But I was wondering whether we could talk about the powers, like how they source their powers, because it's mentioned that it's atmosphere when they go onto the ship.
I was a bit confused by this.
I've always thought it was sun's rays.
I think it's meant to be both. It's because they do talk about the sun as well. Jor-El talks about the sun charging his cells early on. So there's clearly the sun has something to do with it, but they do also then confuse it
and
with
the
this
masks.
Whole,
yeah.
With this whole
that's
Kryptonian
what I didn't
atmosphere.
Understand. So you've got Superman, super strong, X-ray vision, etc., super senses. And then the other Kryptonians land and they're in their battle armor with their faceplates down. They are super strong. Right, they can't fly yet, but they can do super leaps.
Well, that I guess is a gravity thing.
Why?
Because we have less gravity than Krypton.
Right.
So if they've grown up in a heavier gravity world,
it's John Carter.
That's the John
Carter.
It's
the John Carter.
Okay. That's never explained in the film, is it?
That's there's no basic science, Dan. Come
basic
on.
Science. Okay. All right then. And then the faceplate comes off and then it's like, oh God, I can see you through everything. I can see your underwear. Oh God, I can't handle it.
Anyway, so powers, I basically think that is a bit of a flaw if that's being a little bit dancing around the houses there. It's a flaw.
These are smart Kryptonians. They're seeing one of their own kind run around without a faceplate on. Why don't they just immediately take their faceplates off?
Because they have those mega headaches and they can't control it.
But they don't know they won't have those mega headaches, and then they have them and it takes about 2 minutes to get over it. So that's what I would do.
Maybe they're so smart they've realised that he's already acclimatised.
They
wouldn't.
Possibly.
Because they already know that he won't. Maybe he'd be depowered in their atmosphere.
Maybe that weedy looking Kryptonian on the ship, whose name I forget, you know, as a doctor and went, oh, better be safe, put on your masks.
Yes. And, and they the all one who worked out very, very easily with no explanation how all of the data of the DNA of every single Kryptonian was in his cells. He just went, oh, by the way, I've worked it out. And you go, that's handy.
What do we make of the Codex? The MacGuffin? I don't think they needed it. Did they need it? They don't need a MacGuffin in Superman. They don't need Zod to have a greater purpose other than just hating the son of Jor-El, do they?
But you, I guess you need that greater purpose for Zod, because if he's just hating on Jor-El, it makes him less sympathetic.
Yeah, unrelatable. Whereas there,
why does he need to be sympathetic?
Well, no, but I think it makes him a more nuanced...
The Joker isn't sympathetic.
Yeah, but the Joker is like an insanoid.
So is Zod.
Yeah. But I kind of feel sorry for Joker because, you know, he's obviously got problems. He needs help.
Wow.
This and that's why they send him to Arkham.
I'm getting more worried with Badan by
a
second,
little bit.
To be honest.
I'm not sure.
But yeah, Zod was a big problem for me. I didn't particularly like this iteration of Zod. I worship at the feet of Terrence Stamp Zod, who, and you know, people will back me up in this, the late great Pav Basra and I used to be able to bat Terrence Stamp Zod quotes from Superman 2 back and forth
endlessly,
pretty much all day. I can't think of a single memorable thing that this Zod does or says during the course of the entire movie, which is a major problem given
he debates the merits of genocide with a ghost.
The lines are clunky. I've actually written a few of them down, especially in that final fight. There are lines like, "You are a monster, Zod, and I've got to stop you."
Yes.
Here's another one. "There's only one way this ends. Either you die or I do." Now, could that be foreshadowing something?
What?
Does he press a button at any point and go, "Zod, attack!"
Punch strike! And there's another great bit. That's a bit where I unintentionally laughed. It's very Pulitzer Prize for me, which is, "If you love these people so much..." And I thought he was going to turn around and go, "Why don't you marry them?"
Anyway, I don't think he should have killed Zod. I think they should have depowered him somehow and stuck him in the Phantom Zone again, or something.
There's an interesting, question which we were discussing yesterday, and this is, again, nerdy, stick with me. Can you break a Kryptonian neck on Earth?
I would say yes, you can.
If
you're another Kryptonian, yeah. You would have the force necessary to do that.
But that means, I mean, we've always considered, you know, Superman pretty much invulnerable. I mean, that means he's not actually. If you had a giant machine with giant pincers, you could, you know.
Presumably, that's what Lex Luthor will be building in the
He'll
next
be building
movie.
That any minute now.
My giant Superman neck breaking machine.
Mechanical spider.
Need a new name.
I'm glad you mentioned the next film.
Yes. Dan, I don't just throw this shit together. I've got a list of topics here, and I'm trying desperately to get through them one by one.
All right.
Let's talk about the next one.
With the line, Welcome to the planet. Which is a great
line. That was a good
line. Is that the last line in the movie? Does he say anything in response to that, or does he just smile?
He smiles and just looks handsome, I think. Which is my trick.
It's
a bit hot.
He smiles and looks kind of hot. Everywhere turned for him. I didn't.
We were talking earlier sort of about this mass destruction that we've seen happen, you know, in this city, which they barely recognise as being Metropolis. So much of this city, Metropolis, has been destroyed. And we've seen the LexCorp logo around, haven't we?
We have, yes.
So
the gas tank.
Yep. I believe that all that mass destruction happened for a reason, which is, who's going to get the rebuilding contracts?
You don't think?
I think it's going to be LexCorp, and Lex Luthor is going to come in as the builder of the new metropolis, this new city. And I think maybe there might be some Kryptonian tech around that he might sweep up during the
some Jatari guns that have been left lying around.
And that could be something to do with how Luthor rises for the sequel, which should, I think, be called Man of Tomorrow. Because it's going to be set in this new city.
Wow. I'm on board.
I'm sold. We were talking about this in the main podcast, that Superman doesn't really have a great rogues gallery. And I'm not a huge Superman comic book reader, so all I know is Brainiac and Doomsday and Luthor and General Zod. And now they've got Zod out of the way, you kind of have to go Luthor in a way. It kind of seems to be the done thing now.
Brainiac would be interesting because he hasn't been done on screen.
At all, yeah.
So that might be something to play with.
Apart from he's in Smallville, presumably?
Yes.
Tell me about Brainiac.
Helen, tell us about Brainiac.
Chris, over to you.
Dan, tell us about Brainiac.
I'm not a big expert on the law. The way I understand it is Brainiac is an alien android. basically. I can't remember if he's actually Kryptonian.
Mega super intelligent.
But I mean, we've already established in this universe that there are other alien races and other alien planets. I can't remember which race, but yeah, he's basically an artificial alien being who is, as you can tell from the name, which I believe was a confluence of the word brain and the word maniac.
What?
Yeah. Is he the one, if I've got this wrong, then obviously please direct your rage at me, but he's the one who has technology to shrink.
Yes, yes. He shrinks cities.
And he shrinks Metropolis, doesn't he?
And that's
he?
Kind of a, that's yeah. kind of an ongoing thing. He shrinks Metropolis. He also shrinks, I've forgotten the name now, a Kryptonian city, which Superman spends basically, has basically a city in a bottle in the Fortress of Solitude and spends much of his time trying
Kandor,
to... Kandor, yes, thank you.
And wasn't he the bad guy in the J.J. Abrams... Or an earlier iteration of the Superman
script. Yes, I think he was.
Was it Tim
Burton? I think it was Flyby. No,
was it the Tim Burton one? No?
He was in there with another baddie who was slightly more physical.
No, is it Doomsday or Darkseid who kills Superman?
Doomsday.
Tell me about Doomsday.
Basically, giant alien bad guy who killed Superman.
Giant alien bad guy, that's what I'm getting. What does he look like?
Yeah. Really ugly. Like, seriously ugly. Yeah.
Is he like the monster at the end of Watchmen in the original book?
No, he's not that big. He's humanoid, but bigger than Superman and very scary.
Have you thought the Sword Superman fight was monotonous? Just you wait until you read The Death of Superman, because it is literally, the last issue literally just a powerful man punching another powerful man over 24 single-page panels until one of them dies.
What might be more interesting, to do something along the lines of maybe All-Star Superman, which was a really good comic arc, which had Superman rescuing a mission to the sun from falling into the sun, absorbing too much cosmic radiation, with the result that his powers got more and more and more powerful, and he got more intelligent, and he could fly faster, he could do everything better, but also it was going to kill him in a few months, and it was sort of how he spent his last days and weeks.
So a bit like that Doctor Who episode with David Tennant saying goodbye to him.
Pretty much.
So it all comes back to the Doctor for some reason, doesn't it? It's weird.
I found that the fight between the giant space terraforming machine, when it had the three arms of pincushion death, snakeness.
The tripod, let's call it.
I didn't really engage with that at all. I was like, oh, so you're fighting this machine that's chasing you, CGI, CGI, CGI. How does he defeat it? Well, he gets underneath it and then just Supermans it to
death. He basically does a Randy Quaid in Independence Day.
And survives. But, you see, the important thing is that Jenny the intern didn't die.
I had no emotional connection with Jenny the intern.
Is Jenny meant to be Jimmy Olsen?
No, I don't think so. I think Jenny's meant to be Jenny, and it's meant to be for the gag of trawling the intern pool at the end. But Jenny is supposed to be, I think, the innocent that we're meant to feel
I didn't
for.
Care about Jenny.
No, nor did I. And it was a problem with that
I was
scene.
Glad when
we saw Perry White with his little diamond earring, like, getting the, you know, the street sign, putting it into the rubble and trying to lift her out. I went, well, I'm not really that fussed. I mean, there are so many people have died now. I'm not engaged. I'd actually rather just see more of Superman flying into the air, Zod coming at him, and then him just punching him.
Or throw him into a giant Coke sign like they do in Superman 2.
Ah, it's delicious, isn't it?
Yeah, there was a lot of Coke on the early Superman films, wasn't there?
That's what I heard,
Yeah.
Any other Easter eggs that we perhaps might have missed?
I've got a whole bunch of them. The biggest one is on the side of the satellite, which I'm proud to brag as well here.
Yes.
That I informed both Dan and Ian, who saw the film first. I said, did you not see the Wayne Enterprises sign on the side of the satellite? So that's a big one. There's also, if we count all the LexCorp ones, there's the LexCorp construction site, which says the future is yours or ours or now.
Well, there you go. See, that feeds into my theory about the sequel
as well. Exactly. Yeah. So that's
the future belongs
site.
To me, kind of a...
That kind of thing. Yeah. Then you've got the gas tank. And the very subtle one, which I went, wow, this is actually pretty good, is the removal truck that you see when he is hitchhiking and goes back to see his mum. That they all say LexCorp. Sullivan's, the workshop, is a reference to Smallville, the TV show. There is also the Spartans, the Smallville Spartans, which I think is a gag about... 300, that's the football team in that town.
Oh, right.
What else is an Easter egg? Oh, yeah, the Utopia Casino. We only discover this in the interview, but that's connecting to the character who I forget the name of off the top of my head, who brings kryptonite to Earth. He is from. He's part of this.
Oh, that's interesting. Because there's no mention of kryptonite. You know, kryptonite is a huge part of the first movie.
Yeah, I like that.
I think that'll have to be in some way be part of either this sequel or the next one, wherever comes up next. I mean, they'd be fools to not incorporate it in some way.
Well, Luther has to have in some way to render.
Yeah.
Superman. Relatively powerless.
And you also have the fact that, you know, the US government is already trying to spy on him with drones, so it would make sense that they would also be like, okay, these Kryptonians showed up, destroyed half the city, what do we do next time?
Yeah.
Let's see if there's anything out there.
So, like, you know, Nick Fury with the Phase 2 technology.
Exactly.
And, it was also a very small sign for Blaze Comics, which is very important for people who know DC's old lore, so that's fun.
Can I point at my favourite one? It's the polar bear. The polar bear's there for a reason. It's not just a random polar bear. It's because John Peters, who's exec producer on this, but he rather famously, during the attempts to make Superman Lives. Insisted that there should be polar bears at the Fortress of Solitude. And he actually... maybe I'm misremembering. He actually wanted them wearing armour and he wanted them to be fighting and stuff.
Have he been reading Philip Pullman?
Or? Yeah, well, this is pre-Pullman.
Oh, God.
It's crazy. So they have, and I believe they've corroborated this. They snuck in the polar bear as a special tribute to John Peters.
Are the giant three-legged Kryptonian ships then a little bit of a nod to him as well? Because he always liked mechanical spiders, didn't he?
Well, he got those in Wild Wild West.
Yeah,
well,
he got that in Wild Wild West.
He finally got his giant mechanical spider.
He gets everything eventually. It just takes 10, 15 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Do we think the mention of Wayne Enterprises, is there any significance to be read into that? Or is it as simple a throwaway gag as, for example, Val Kilmer mentioning Metropolis in Batman Forever or the mention of Gotham in Superman Returns?
David S. Goyer expands upon this and he views it as a clean slate. He views it as an opportunity to say this isn't necessarily... In fact, he said it isn't the world where Christian Bale's Batman is there, but it is the world where a Batman exists and the rest of the Justice League exist in this world. And that was just to remind you that, sure, Superman is here and he is kind of a big deal, but there is a grander world here. And he's viewing this as the kind of clean slate, the opening pitch for a DC universe.
Maybe. Well, he'd have to be the first, wouldn't he?
Maybe with the Kryptonian stuff coming down and, you know, maybe bits of Kryptonian, like, spore or germs got into Earth's atmosphere and that's going to power up other people.
Could happen.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll happen, Dan. he's got to be the first one, hasn't he, though? I mean, you say, for example, Batman, who doesn't have any powers, is fine, but... You know, to have Superman suddenly show up and display all these amazing abilities, and then people are going, oh, yeah, but that's fine, because we saw that Green Lantern dude do something like that a while back, and that Flash fella, he can do that as well. And Aquaman, don't even get me started on that guy. So he kind of has to be the first, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's because now all the Kryptonian germs are in the atmosphere.
Okay. Sure, let's go with that. But I mean, it's something that Goyer, I think, touched on yesterday, which is that, you know, he suspects that if Warner's does Justice League, they won't take the Avengers approach and establish everyone or nearly everyone separately.
That would be too much like common sense, if you ask me.
They would start with Justice League and work outwards, which is what they were planning to do sort of 5-6 years ago.
Oh, I know. With there was George a mistake Miller's, back then as well.
I will reserve judgment until we know more, but it seems a bold strategy.
If they do Justice League, will Henry Cavill be the Superman in that Justice League?
That seems to be up in the air.
Okay.
I'm a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. And I can safely say that that's what they're going to do.
Okay.
With apologies to the Pulitzer Committee.
And the Prize Committee.
I'm a Pulitzer Prize certificate printing off winner journalist.
As someone who can spell Pulitzer Prize, I think I have a few things to say about this.
We've got to wrap up soon, but we haven't really touched upon the performances, so not that that really matters in the spoiler podcast necessarily, but what do we make of the performances, and what do we make of Henry Cavill as Kal-El / Clark Kent?
I felt like a role he was slowly warming up to. He seemed, it's partly the way it's written. It's partly because he doesn't have Clark Kent to fall back on and find a way in through. But he didn't seem massively comfortable, but just as Kal-El himself isn't massively comfortable for various reasons. But I, I, you know, but I kind of have a problem with the character of Superman for this reason as well. He's kind of, there's not a lot to warm to or to hook on to or to, yeah, all right,
know.
Okay,
I
he's got big man breasts, but, you know.
Pecs,
Dan. Oh, yeah, that's what they're called.
The first movie, the Christopher Reeve Superman, is impossible not to like. Either as Clark Kent, any iteration of Clark Kent, whether it's a small folk Kent or...
Yeah. I mean, he's not being Clark Kent. He's not that interesting.
Superman, his Superman is noble and warm and human.
He's cool.
And cool as well. And I really adore that iteration of the character. I thought Brandon Routh did a fantastic job in Superman.
Brandon Routh was very good.
And has been, I think, you know, sadly overlooked for this one. Cavill is fine, but the Clark Kent in this movie lacks definition. I think you're absolutely right. He's lost soul. I don't want to see my Superman being tortured. I don't want to see him have an existential crisis. Mm. I want to see him being good and loyal and honest and decent, because we don't get a lot of that.
I kind of like the edge that you got towards the end, though. This, you know, he smashes the satellite or whatever it was, the missile thing, the drone, whatever it was.
But I go back,
and you know, there is this element of he's not only an illegal immigrant, he's a weapon of mass destruction.
Yeah, true. Which is a very modern take on it, but I do kind of miss the Superman who, at the end of Superman 2, apologizes to the American president for letting him and the country and the world down, and says it won't happen again, sir. I want that Superman back, not this conflicted guy who could go either way.
I thought Cavill was good. I just didn't think the script gave him a heck of a lot of character scenes in a bizarre way. Even though he's on screen, you know, most of the time, it didn't feel like there was much there to work with. Maybe I'm being unfair, I don't know.
That's kind of, I suppose, if you're going to draw a parallel with Batman Begins, it's almost like for the whole film, he's the Bruce Wayne that was, you know, hiding out and acting like a bum and what have you, all the way to the very end, whereas in Batman Begins, he returns as Bruce Wayne about halfway through.
I hadn't thought of that. That's very good. Superman is often painted as a Christ figure sometimes, you know, rather overtly. Superman Returns, where he literally comes back from the dead and falls to earth in a crucified pose, for God's sake. Anyway, but I really like that movie, but there are a couple of missteps. this one, is it a third? I didn't really see that much.
He's 33.
Really? He's 33. There's a scene in a church where he is in one corner of the frame, and right behind him in the window is Christ kneeling in the Gardens of Gethsemane, debating his future, as Clark also
kneeling
debates
before God
what he should be doing to in his future, and if he should sacrifice himself to save the world. So there's a little bit of a parallel in that
scene. There is a bit where he
spreads out his arms and does a crucifix pose shortly after.
When the people have fallen into the water at the oil rig, he is a fisher of men.
He's also a fisherman, literally, on a boat.
That is true, yes, he does fish. There are fish. That he gathers in.
I'm sure the loaves are out of shot.
But as David Goyer would want us to point out, he's also a Moses figure as well. So he was obviously created by two Jewish writers. And indeed, this time Goyer himself is Jewish. And, you know, there's baby in the bulrushes sent away by his parents to save him from a terrible fate and raised on a new world. So, there's a bit of that going on. And also there's the idea of him leading us out of the wilderness as well. Basically, the metaphor is very, very much there. In fact, no points for getting it, but probably minus points if you don't see it. It's interesting that Snyder, I think, particularly was kind of keen on keeping that and emphasizing that.
Cool. And he is a god among us, isn't he?
He is
a god to us.
He is. All in all, though, I kind of preferred the same movie when it was called Thor. But having said that, I am kind of excited about where they can go with the sequel now they've set it up. I don't know how they're going to do the Clark Kent disguise thing in Deadly
Planet.
I'm
really worried about it.
A little bit worried about that. But, the scale of this movie is fast. It is epic. I thought, I had problems for the last hour or so, but exciting times ahead.
Absolutely. As I've already said, I think there's some really interesting places it can go. And I really look forward, and I'm making a big assumption that Luther's going to come into it for the second one, but it feels right in the way they brought in Joker for the second one.
John Harrison.
Exactly. He will bring an element, just as Gene Hackman did, and just as Kevin Spacey did so brilliantly. He will bring an element which this film lacked, which is the villain being humorous. The villain
I really hope.
You know,
they're tough on humor, tough on the causes of humor in this movie, and I hope that's not going to continue in the sequel.
Yeah, and I hope that kind of levity will come, because one of the things I love about Luther as Superman's foe cinematically is he doesn't take Superman seriously. you know, he's an opposite in that sense. Superman takes himself very seriously, what he does very seriously, and Luthor's just like, hey, it's just a joke, and I'm gonna.
That's actually one of the problems of Superman Returns at the end of it, when he actually is stabbing in the side, spearing him in the side. There's another Christ
there
reference. When he's stabbing him with real anger and real hatred, and I kind of feel that the Gene Hackman Luthor would never felt that way about Superman. And I felt that was another little misstep within the tone of the Singer world, which is obviously the same tone as the Donner and Lester worlds. We shall see. I'm looking forward to seeing what they can do with that. Who could play him? I don't know. Bring Hackman out of retirement. This is the carrot. This will be the one that will bring him back.
Tom Hardy shaved his head before.
Tom Hardy's playing a bad guy in every
DC movie. Yeah. Timothy Oliphant.
No, Timothy he's best Oliphant. As a good guy.
And yeah.
Does good bald, though.
He does good bald.
He could have been Superman.
The Staith.
The Staith as Lex Luthor.
The
all
Rock.
All comes back to the Staith. The Rock. I feel sorry for Superman in that case. I don't think he'd survive that one. Okay, that's pretty much it for our mad ramblings. Time now for those interviews. Ali spoke to Zack Snyder on his Todd. And then you were joined by Helen for David S. Goyer, correct?
Indeed.
Enjoy.
If you haven't seen the film by now,
please.
I just don't even know what to talk to you about. No, I'm talking like if it's in the future. Yeah, exactly. No. Like, don't spoil it. But don't spoil it. Really?
There were many, many little grace notes I enjoyed in the film. And of course, the film is much more than grace notes. But there were a few that just put a big geeky smile on my face. And obviously, there were the LexCorp stuff that we had on the side of the truck and on the gas tank and the buildings. And by the way, I love the joke where when Superman slams into the 106 days since an accident, it goes to zero when he comes down. All of that stuff.
I'm glad you saw that, by the way. I always, whenever I watch the movie, I see that and I'm like, is anyone seeing this? Because I think it's funny. No? Okay. maybe on a second viewing or whatever.
But these are the more obvious ones. The other ones that kind of have crept into my mind as I'm falling to sleep, I go, hang on, is that one? We saw Utopia Casino. A big sign for that. And that's I looked funny. That up, and that's Tony Gallo, right?
That's funny, yeah. Well, yeah, and that's DJ, my visual effects supervisor. He snuck that in there, and I was like, that's awesome.
Blaze Comics, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And is this all your visual effects supervisor who's just kind of...
It's a bit of that. It's a bit of that. But it's all stuff that we talk about, and we go, oh, that's fun. We should do that. Like, there's definitely a really subtle inside the... we call it laser eye head, which is where they're battling with where Zod's tearing the building apart with his laser vision, laser vision, whatever you want to call it. We call it heat vision, but it's more than that. And there is a B-common called Batman on the wall in there, just really small. You might have to like even stop the movie to see it, but it's definitely in there.
That's Blu-ray stuff.
Yeah, and that's basically that's also Dean Egg, who worked on Dean Egg is the visual effects company here in London that worked on all the Dark Knight movies. And they definitely, you know, they did that. Yeah, they thought like, oh, that's... And I was like, that's awesome.
And obviously, the bit that where I just went, oh, I was like, hats off, was obviously the satellite. Where you only catch up... We catch on two run paths.
Yeah.
And it's just the symbol, and you can kind of see it.
It says Wayne. It does say Wayne underneath, but it's just you can see half the word, yeah. Well, for me, that was a couple things. I really just wanted to say, in the DC universe, in this DC universe, and whether or not it's the Wayne Enterprises of... Chris Nolan's movies or whether it's the Wayne Enterprises of DC in general, that's also yet to be seen. But that particular reference was there for me to say also to Chris, like, thanks, you know, for helping me out with this. And, you know, you're awesome and cool guy. And I just want to say that I appreciate it. Right. Mm. But it also means for me that, you know, Batman's out there somewhere.
Yeah, there is a Batman.
There is a Batman, and he's out in the world somewhere. Yeah.
You have the polar bear. It made it into a Superman movie. Yeah. John Peters got his wish.
Unfortunately, there was no battle, but yeah, it was funny because I had drawn that. When I was drawing the storyboards, I was laughing to myself, and I drew a whole drawing. We did a dolly shot originally. We didn't shoot it, but I had drawn it as this like dolly move where we're like with a polar bear, and he's lumbering across the ice flows, and he finally like he jumps a couple and then he leaps one and then and it proved to be a lot more difficult to photograph than I had imagined, and I definitely did not want to do a CG polar bear, right?
Yeah.
I said no way, it's gotta be a real polar bear. And so that footage is IMAX footage that we got from this IMAX documentary about the polar regions, and then we talked to them and they let us use it, you know, they spent like 6 months on a Russian icebreaker looking for polar bears, and we just weren't going to do it. I mean, it would have been, we had it worked out that we were going to bring the polar bear, we're going to put all these ice floes on stage and shoot him on stage with a green screen behind him, and we were training him physically to leap.
You were training a polar bear?
Yeah, to jump from ice floe to ice floe. And but also it's super dangerous to film. I'm like, there's only one guy who has a polar bear in Canada. And
I think I've seen the video of that guy.
Yeah. And he was like, you know, you can't, as we talked about it, it got more and more dodgy. Like, he's like, okay, it sounded really easy at first. He was like, oh yeah, we'll just, you just put him over there and jump. And then he's like, okay, but no one can be in the room. And you have to put these electric things around everybody because he won't, so he won't murder everyone. And I was like, oh, okay, so wait a minute. Is this polar bear really trained? Is it like dangerous? He's like, oh no, it's not dangerous. I mean, unless of course he sees you or, you know, sees something shiny or a flash of light or something. I'm like, that's easily, on a film set that happens all the time. He goes, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there is a chance he could maul us all, but, and I was like, okay, well maybe this is not what we should be doing. Anyway, so then we found the footage, so it was okay.
And it all worked out. And then you got the logo of the, is it Arctic Cargo?
Arctic Cargo, yeah.
Yeah, I thought I spotted that. I went, oh, there it is. But then you gave me the actual bear. The other thing, the huge thing for me, that kind of, oh, wow moment, is seeing Clark get into the lift at the end, push the glasses up his nose. You know, was that something you really worked really hard on to get just right?
Get the timing just right, yeah. I really just wanted you to just get a glimpse of it. Because really, in the end of the movie is the beginning, right? Because he's just... at the Daily Planet, has become the Superman that we know.
It's almost Clark Kent origins.
It is. That's really a nice way of putting it, because for me, that's what it was all about. It was like, and we could have started this movie with that scene. Mm. Like, he literally could start a movie with him getting off his bike and getting on an elevator, putting these glasses and coming up and having, you know, Perry White go, guys, this is our new stringer, Clark Kent, you know, and having Lois say, welcome to the planet. And
what
then
line.
The movie could start, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great line. And it was in the first draft of the script I read.
So like, originally the first draft had a kind of flashback type thing or?
Yeah, it did, actually. It did. It actually had more of it, even on Krypton. There was like the structure of Krypton was crazy. Mm. And we kind of linearized that because it was like the birth, and then it was like all these flashbacks within flashbacks and the timing of Zod's approach. And there was like a... there was a bigger battle that I had designed on the landing platform, and we shot some of it, but it got, for budgetary reasons, we made it smaller and smaller, and then it got to the point where I was like, let's just have the battle inside. Because he has this robot who's like, you know, Kelex and Kelor, and there was a scene where Kelex dons a artificial body that is like a robotic body, and they battle out on the landing platform. And we'd actually had Zod had these like this pack of sort of genetically engineered sort of like war dogs that like leaped off and like ran ahead, and he, you know, Kelex and he were fighting the war dogs, and finally Kelex like takes these like detonation like explosives out of his robotic body, arms them, and says like, you know, save the, he turns to Jor-El and says like, get the kid off, basically I'm gonna try and hold him off, and then he just runs and dives in one of those drop ships and blows himself up, and and that makes like Zod really mad, because Zod's still circling, and then he lands, and then Zod goes in and they fight. So
I gather there were hidden symbols and meanings to, this is what David Escoy was telling me, to the walls and the encryptions of the Kryptonian language, and you really went to town on the language.
Yeah, there was a great one of my favorite quotes is this Joseph Campbell quote that says, and it's basically on the walls inside of there. There's a bunch of like, you know, the sort of classic Superman poetry about like, you know, I am the son of Ra and blah, blah, blah. All the kind of classic, you know, where he talks about, you know, the different moons and all that stuff. And then there's this Joseph Campbellian thing that I love where he says like, which I felt like was really appropriate to Superman, where he says, where I thought to find an abomination, I found a god. Where I thought to slay another, I slay myself. Where I thought to travel outward, I travel to the center of my own existence. And where I thought to be alone, I shall be with all the world, right? That's this, like, Joseph Campbell says it about, you know, sort of the hero's journey, whatever. And I always thought it was super appropriate for Superman because it's really like, that's his whole story in a nutshell. And so we put that, that's also in Kryptonian on the walls inside the...
Right, so you have a scene where Superman kills a man. Not in cold blood, obviously.
Mm.
Can you tell me the thought mm-hmm. process to deliver that? Because that was an incredible moment.
Yeah, I guess for me, and I, in the original version of the script, he just got zapped into the Phantom Zone. David and I had long talks about it, and Chris and I talked long about it, and I was like, I really feel like we should kill Zod, and I really feel like Superman should kill him. And the why of it was, for me, I go, if it's truly an origin story, his aversion to killing is unexplained. It's just in his DNA, and I felt like we needed him to do something, just like him putting on the glasses or going to the Daily Planet or any of the other things that you're sort of seeing for the first time that you realize will then become sort of his thing. I felt like if we could find a way of making it impossible for him, like, you know, Kobayashi Maru, totally no way out. Sorry about the dorkiness there.
You were in good company.
I felt like that could also make you go, okay, this is the why of him not killing ever again, right? Like he's basically obliterated his entire people and his culture, and he is responsible for it. And he's just like, I can't, how could I kill ever again? Even though Zod says to him, like, look, there's no way this ends without, like, what are you going to do? Put me in a jail? Like, I don't know what you're going to do with me, but I'm going to just keep doing this until you stop me.
I'm engineered.
Yeah. Like, I'm just a killing machine, and that's what I'm going to do now. And especially now when I've got, like, I had a task before, which was to rebuild Krypton, but you've robbed me of that task. Like, the task is gone. There's no chance of the task. So now what am I going to do? All I am is a killing machine. So I'm going to start doing that. And I just felt like it was, we were able to create like this. I wanted to create this scenario where you really, Superman, either he's going to see those people get chopped in half, or he's got to do what he's got to do. And I think Zod knows that. It's like, it's almost like, you know,
suicide in its way.
In a way it is. It's like death by cop, you know, in a way. It's like I think he knows, like, there's no, if I think in my mind, it's like, if Cal has the ability to kill him, then that's a noble way for him to die. It's like that whole, like, a good death is his own reward sort of concept in the movie. And I think that for me was, you know, and also I think and if there were more adventures for Superman to go on, you then are also given this thing where you don't know 100% what he's going to do. Like, I think that when you really put in stone the concept that he won't kill, and it's totally in stone, it really erases an option in the viewer's mind. Now, I think that doesn't mean that he doesn't now have a code that he's like, okay, I just can't do that. This has got to be outside of my existence. I got to find another way if that's how it is. But again, you'll always have in the back of your mind this little thing of like, well, like, how far can you push him, right? Mm. Like, is it going to, like, if he sees Lois get hurt, or if he sees something like, or his mother get killed or something, like, you just made like a really mad Superman that we know is capable of some really horrible stuff if he wants to be.
My thoughts after seeing it was, he's only human. And then I went, nope, he is not.
Yeah, but that's the thing that's cool about him, I think, in some ways. The idea that he has the frailties of a human, sort of emotionally, but you don't want to get that guy mad because, you know.
Yeah, he's a big guy.
He's, yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been so fun.
Very, very, very fascinating. Here's to next time around.
All right. Awesome.
Thank you,
cheers.
Cheers.
We have here David S. Goyer, the writer, one of the writers for Man of Steel, and a producer, and many other things. There must have been many drafts for this. What were you saddest to see go when you were going through the different drafts? You came up with an idea and went, doesn't fit, but if only.
I mean, amazingly, that not that much went. We refined things, but the film that you've seen is 75% what was the first draft. All the big broad strokes. There weren't any characters that were different or things like that. There were a couple of small scenes that were cut that I don't even think Zach's going to put them. I don't think there's going to be a director's cut.
Okay.
I'm not sure. He may have said something different on the DVD. And I don't know if he's going to include those deleted scenes. There was a tiny scene when Ma and Pa Kent, even though I hate referring to them as that, Jonathan and Martha, because I just think that's Ma and Pa Kent is so anachronistic. And one of the things that we were trying to do with Superman is just get him out of that Norman Rockwell sort of big blue Boy Scout feel. There was a tiny scene in which they take, I think he's 6 months old, Cal, to the doctor because he's behaving in a weird way, and they do this because his super senses are starting to kick in, and they do this test where they which they do with newborns, where they put these tones in their ears to check their hearing, and the doctor starts sort of increasing the amplitude of the tones, and then the baby screams and it blows out like all the windows of like the doctor's office and the windshields and the cars outside. And it was a funny scene, but we decided that originally you cut from the pod landing to that scene to the fishing trawler. And we've just felt it was a more dramatic way to go, to just get rid of, to go straight to the fishing trawler. And also coming off the destruction of Krypton, it was a little too early to have something that was just ha ha ha. So there was that. There was a tiny, tiny scene that was filmed uncut in which after Lois is captured by the FBI, in which they're sort of interrogating her and putting the screws to her, and she says, "I won't talk." There was an action scene that was never filmed there. They did a demonstration of their capabilities. They drop some Kryptonians down and mess up some cities. They drop Fiora down in Shanghai and she messes up some stuff. And so there was like another 5-page action scene. And,
oh wow!
But we just thought it was too much, and we thought that, so we never filmed it. We cut that one. There's plenty of action in this film. I mean, some people have said there's too much action in the film.
You bring the action very much home.
I mean, one of the things that we set out to do with this film, and we always knew that it would be even riskier than reinventing Batman, is because Batman is already a darker, more realistic character. But one of the lessons that Chris and I learned from Batman was, if you're going to revitalize an iconic figure like that, you have to be prepared to slay some sacred cows. And you have to be prepared to sort of weather the slings and arrows of some people saying that you're going to do that. And you have to respect the canon, but constantly question the canon. Because if you don't reinvent, and these characters are constantly being reinvented in the comic books, then they become stagnant, and then they cease to become relevant. And we were feeling that Superman, and I think a lot of people were feeling that Superman, at least in films, was ceasing to become relevant. Mm-hmm. So some of the things that we questioned were, shouldn't Lois figure out who he is? It just seemed idiotic that she couldn't.
She's Pulitzer Prize winner.
Yeah, exactly. But also, I have this, you know, people say that a hero is only as good as his or her villain, but I also think a hero is only as good as his or her love interest. And if he's going to fall in love with this woman, she has to be pretty special. And it's interesting, even Warner Brothers at first questioned that, because that's just the way it's always been, that she couldn't figure it out. And we just thought, we can't do that. It's going to make her look like an idiot. And if we're trying to depict it in a more realistic, relatable way, and I say realistic in air quotes, we had to get rid of that, the underpants. But also Smallville, I thought, if we really want to drive home the sort of danger and the enormity of what's happening, it would be great to have the first big Earth action sequence happen in Smallville and have the place get pretty well destroyed.
So you're pretty much literally driving it home.
Yeah, literally driving it home. And also we wanted to make it personal, and we thought, the bad guys, you know, Zod, they figure out where he is. And also buried in that is the implication that, I don't know if you guys got this when you saw the movie, is in our minds, Zach and my minds, Deb, we think there are people in Smallville that know his secret, that share, like Pete Ross, that share that secret.
I was wondering whether it was always Zod. I know that this didn't arrive to you in a dream, obviously, but
no, it was always Zod. It was always odd for two reasons. One, Zach and I, and this is even before Zach, Chris and I, we wanted to make a science fiction film. We wanted to take Superman back to his roots. And we wanted to come up with a threat. One of the things that always bothered me, and I adore the Donner films, was he goes into the Fortress of Solitude and then he just comes out in that costume and just starts wearing that costume and flying around wearing that costume. It's one thing to sort of, you know, emerge with these superpowers. It's another thing to possibly help people. But why put on the costume and make a public statement about it? I'm serious. And so the thinking behind this film was, if he's going to do that, his coming out, if you will, has to be a really big event. It has to be something, you know, earth-shattering. It always also bothered me that people glossed over the fact that he's an alien. And I had said to Chris Nolan early on that even if he had no superpowers, if the world found out he existed, it would be the biggest story that happened in human history. And that meant a First Contact story, and that led us to Zod. Zod was also important because I wanted it to be a story about two fathers, and Zod is a link back to his Kryptonian heritage, his lineage. You know, Zod at one time was friends with Jor-El, and so I wanted the fate of the world to rest on, or we wanted the fate of the world to rest on, in effect, which heritage he was going to choose, you know? And we wanted to give him this Sophie's choice. You can have the human race, or you can have, you know, because he could have resurrected Krypton on Earth, and they could have turned Earth into Krypton, and he could have had that world back, and we wanted him to have to choose between the two.
Mm. Hence, you get that, I think, from just that the agony of that cry when he does kill Zod, which must have been another.
Killing Zod was discussion. A huge one. I mean, but yes, there's a sadness in that, because he's literally killing the last of his kind. He doesn't want to do it, and we've always said that Zod is not a villain; he's an antagonist. You know, Zod is doing what he thinks is right for the Kryptonians. Killing Zod was a big thing, and that was something that Chris Nolan originally said, there's no way you can do this. That was a change. Originally, Zod got sucked into the Phantom Zone along with the others, and I just felt it was unsatisfying, and so did Zach. And we started questioning. We talked to some of the people at DC Comics and said, do you think there is ever a way that Superman would kill someone? And at first they said, no way, no way. And we said, but what if he didn't have a choice? And originally Chris didn't even want to let us try to write it. And Zach and I said, we think we can figure out a way that you'll buy it. And so I came up with this idea of the heat vision and these people about to die. And I wrote the scene and I gave it to Chris and he said, okay, you convinced me, I buy it. And I think it's a shocking, I mean, I've seen the film with an audience about four times now, and everyone always gasps when it happens. They don't see it coming. And I think it makes some people feel uncomfortable. Mm. Other people say, right on. But that was the point. And hopefully what we've done with the end of this film is we've gotten people to the mainstream audience, not the geek audience, to question. Hopefully we've redefined Superman.
Sure. And jumping back to the alter ego Clark Kent Superman, when he puts his glasses on, he's a different person type thing.
Obviously, we sidestepped it in this movie.
You did, and it quite delicately, but come the end, you're trapped, I feel. Maybe not trapped. I mean, obviously, you're the professional writer.
You mean if we do another movie?
Yeah, because he's in a room full of journalists. He's been, you know, the savior of the universe. How do you dance the dance?
It. We were conscious of the fact that obviously, it's not an issue with Lois moving forward. She's his secret keeper, and part of the fun for us if we do move forward is they will be involved in a real relationship, and she would be part of that, maintaining that secret,
yeah,
and maintaining
that
fiction. But you know, it will, part of the fun of doing things like this, though, and Chris has always said this, is sometimes you write yourself into a corner, but you have to follow it to its logical conclusion and then see if you can figure a way out of it. So I think that Perry's not an idiot either. Perry knows they have a connection. Perry saw them kiss. You know, at the end of the film, we're very aware of that. And so one would presume that moving forward, Perry would say, what's the deal here? You know, so if the film is embraced over the next few weeks and we formalize things, that's something we plan to follow up on.
There's also an issue here, I think, which I think the film explores quite well, which is that Superman's not here to do everything himself. He's here to sort of inspire humanity to
yes.
be better and do better.
Well, that was a big point, especially with having the American military take part,
sure.
you know, in the fight as well. But I
and also, well. No, just, you know, you've got essentially got Toby Ziegler saving the world.
Yes, yes. I mean, I think that we wanted the humans to be integral in the plan. We wanted it to be a twofold plan, and we had to go through some gymnastics in order to pull that off. That, you know, Superman has to take care of the world engine while the other C-17 is, you know, flying the pod towards the Black Zero. But he can't do everything, and we wanted the human beings, whether it be Lois, whether it be the military, exactly, to be part of the solution. And another thing that we would hope to follow up on is you know, which is something they've tried to do in the comic books, is, you know, what does he do about world hunger, or what does he do about genocide, and I mean that, you know, in Rwanda, or, you know, who know, you know, for me, part of the fun of reinterpreting these characters is saying what if.
One thing, and this isn't a detraction to the film, but I was looking forward to a Superman montage where he saves loads of different people across the world. Like, that's one of the things I love about Superman movies and just Superman generally. It's him going, right, well, there's a flood here, I'll go solve it.
Well, but you have to remember, this is sort of Superman Begins. And we see him saving kids in Smallville. We see him saving those guys on the oil rig. And we presume Lois refers to other incidences yeah. in the past when he's been doing that as this kind of anonymous savior figure. But once Zod attacks, you know, a couple of people have taken us to task saying, you know, well, once Zod attacks, there's not a lot of humor in it. And I'm like, well, it didn't seem appropriate given, you know, people cutting jokes during 9/11 or something like that, that it just didn't seem appropriate, that there's some humor before, there's some humor after. So again, moving forward, perhaps that's something, you know, this is a movie where the world learns that he exists and he decides to assume the mantle of Superman. So by the end of the film, when he has that scene with General Swanwick, you know, in our minds, the world, you know, has only been aware of Superman, of Cal, I don't know, even by the end of the film, a month, yeah. you know, something like that, 3 weeks. So it's that sort of montage that you're talking about can't really happen yet. Mm. You know what I mean? It presumably would happen in another film or in between the next film.
Sure, exactly. And I've got one last thing to talk about, which is a certain Mr. Jesus Christ. There are parallels here.
Which we didn't... We weren't the first people to draw.
No, absolutely not.
Not at all. 33 years.
It was intentional.
Intentional. Were there others that I didn't pick up on?
Although I want to be quick to point out that Superman was created by two Jews. And so as much as there are parallels to the Christ story, there's also parallels to the Moses story. I mean, they literally put their son, you know, in a bassinet and send him to another world. It's the ultimate immigrant story. I think that it's a savior story, and it's got Old Testament and New Testament roots. But it was very deliberate. I wrote in the script, he's 33 years old. He surrenders himself to humanity, and humanity turns him over, you know, to the quote-unquote bad guys. We just thought for decades people have made those parallels, and, you know, I myself am Jewish, but we just thought, why ignore it? Why not lean into it? You know, I wrote that scene in the church where, you know, we're presuming that Clark grew up Methodist or Lutheran or something like that. And so
Lex Lutheran,
but it would make sense that in this moment of doubt, he can't really, there's absent his mother. There's very few people he can talk to about it, that he might go into a church for solace or something like that. Yeah, why not lean into it?
And a couple of other icons get, I guess, sort of name-checked Wayne Enterprises, LexCorp? Are you tying the universe together a little bit?
The intention is that, I mean, to a certain extent, Zach and I did that. Actually, I didn't even know about he slipped the Wayne.
The design thing,
one
right?
In. Yeah. The LexCorp one was in the script, but the Wayne one, I was like, oh, that's cool. But Zach and I are big fanboys in that regard, in a way that Chris isn't. And so Zach and I will sometimes reference, I mean, we can cite certain covers or, you know, certain artists or things like that, that in a way that Chris just isn't into that. But in our minds, this would be sort of, you know, ground zero for, no pun intended, for, you know, a greater DC universe. That this is a shared universe. And so we're saying, yes, Lex Luthor exists in this world. Bruce Wayne exists in this world. We mentioned Star Labs. And so the intention is, if the film is well received, that this would be the starting point for introducing, you know, other characters. And ultimately, obviously, Warner Brothers hopes there will be a Justice League film. And perhaps you might start seeing, you know, other characters appearing in each other's films. I think in some ways they're interested in sort of going perhaps the opposite direction that Marvel's done, which maybe do a group film and then spin off. I don't know. Mm. But it all depends on your readership.
It does a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, or your listenership. Or, you
know. The everything ship.
If they've got to see the film two or three times.
Empire Raiders, your duty is clear. David Escoyer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's it for our Man of Steel Spoiler Special. Join us on Friday for our regular podcast. And our next Spoiler Special podcast is likely to be, unless we tackle Pacific Rim, The World's End. Ooh. On July 19th. So join us for that, why don't you? Until then, it is goodbye from Dojo.
Goodbye.
A Plums.
Goodbye.
Helen O'Hara.
Goodbye.
I think it's the apostrophe that screws up the Kryptonian name for you.
Well, I just replace it with a...
It'd be Hell Ho, wouldn't it?
Hell Ho. That's another reason why
it would not be Hell Ho.
And it's goodbye for me.